Developing oral skills. We ask children to be quiet. Now later on, we expect them to be able to speak well. How can we do that? We like to look at some ideas. I've given you a handout there. I'm not going to go over much of the handout. I'll go over just pieces of it. And then I'd, however, like to demonstrate a few things that we can talk about, or that would, as that actually will cover some of the thing, rest of the items that are on the handout that I'm not covering directly. Excuse me. The quote that you see on the paper just in front of you, given to you, my observation is, Bruce Barton says, that generally speaking, poverty of speech is the outward evidence of poverty of mind. Basically, what he is saying, that if a person speaks poorly, it's because he thinks poorly. Is that true? Pardon? You are right. Not everybody has the ability to speak well. Now, if a person speaks poorly, we may need to think and look at how well he thinks. But would you agree with me that there are some people who are very, they are not poor thinkers. They are very good thinkers, but they may not necessarily speak well. Okay. There's another thought that is not recorded on your paper, written down. It says this: reading makes a full man. Conversation makes a ready man. Now that's a statement I think I can agree with. We can teach a lot by the students doing reading and writing, and they can gather a lot of information. That doesn't mean that they'll be able to communicate information very well. Okay. What does it help to just fill up the bag, but never to be able to let others have access to that bag? All right. And so we need to teach students how they can use and how they can transfer what they know to others as well. Because what we learning we do in school is not just for us or any learning we do in life. It should be of the benefit to other people as well. We should be able to express it. Now, looking at number one there, what are some of the purposes for developing oral skills? Well, one is to balance the quiet, written, private study with spoken, group, public sharing. What would school be like if all that a student ever did is he came first in there first thing in the morning, sat down on his desk, started reading and writing, and at the end of the day he got up, put his books away, came back, did the same thing the next day. No communication, no discussion, no talking, no instruction. Just, that's all you have. Some school students find school pretty tough as it is already. I think that would not make it any easier. So we want to balance this. There is a fair bit of learning that students do that doesn't come out of a book or that isn't written. Secondly, we want to focus together on one subject and have students and teacher talk about it. And we get ideas from each other. In fact, we can test a person by giving them a test, but another way in which we test how well our students know something is by listening to them, finding out what they know, what they don't know, how well they know things. We do that by speaking and hearing. We want to develop oral and aural skills. Oral has to do with speaking. Aural has to do with hearing. And these two things are only developed by actually doing them. You do not develop oral skills by reading them out of a book. These things are developed by doing. And as I said before, we want to develop a ready mind, not just a full one. And we want to prepare students for when they will be adults, because many of them will likely have opportunity to do some kind of talking. They may teach a class. They may become a school teacher. They may be a minister. They may teach Sunday school. They may have devotional times with their family. They may give a talk, you know, at some occasion. There's always places, one-on-one or group, that we need to communicate, and we need to be able to do it well. To speak clearly, to speak correctly, to speak understandably, so that people can grasp what we're trying to communicate with them. There's all kinds of ways in which we can do this. In school, you probably once in a while have students give a report, right? That they have to stand and give a speech. You know, that's good. That's tremendous. They need to do that. But that's very artificial. Like right now, I'm giving a prepared speech, okay? But a lot of communicating, a lot of talking we do, we don't do that way. That is a prepared speech. A lot of the oral communication, a lot of the oral skills you will teach teachers is by actual interaction between you and your students. And they will watch you. They will listen to you. They will hear you. They will observe what you're doing. And if you are a good communicator, they, by example, can learn to become, hopefully, a good communicator as well. That's how we do, that's how we learn, gather a lot of our oral skills, by watching and listening to other people. True, communication is something that some people are more greatly gifted with than others. But all of us can talk, and so we need to somehow figure out how we can do it better. I'd like to give you some points, these are not on your paper, that you need to consider as teachers when you have oral interaction with your students. The first one is, look at them. Your students would be so impressed if everything you did, you just read out of a book, and then you just, and all you did is you just read this whole thing, and you never looked at them. And if they asked you a question, you would answer by looking down at your book. You didn't look at them. You think that they would look at you? Usually if a student didn't look at me, it's because he was shy or because he was guilty. It's natural when there's communication that we look. And so look at them. When you have discussions, when there's question and answers and so on, that there is eye contact. Because this, the ear contact, as important as it is, very often it depends also on what they see. Because it's not just what they hear, but it's how they gather it in. What does it look like? Look at them. Secondly, be natural with your expression. Sometimes I would have students give an oral report. They said, I want to give an oral report today. My report is about dogs. I like dogs. Dogs are very nice animals. Wow, how inspiring. Is that natural, normal? No, it isn't. It's very artificial. How would you like to have an ordinary discussion with a person like that? I think we'd soon find somebody else to talk to, maybe even a post. Be naturally expressive. And it's true, we're not all equally, we're all not the same this way. Some people use a lot more expression than others. That's okay. Please don't try to be another teacher. You have to be who you are. I visit a lot of classrooms, and my job as a school rep for Christian Light is not to inspect. I don't do that. But it's interesting the things that I sometimes do notice. I recall one particular school, and it's not around here, so you're safe. Don't worry. I get into a classroom, and as soon as the teacher got ready to teach a lesson, the volume went up. I thought, I didn't think that these were hard of hearing people. And she just kept going at that rate the whole time. I would have got very tired by the end of the day having her as my teacher. Because it was a loud, unnatural tone. Talk normal. You may need to talk louder depending on the size of your group. But talk in a somewhat of a normal, restful tone. You don't need to shout. I hope not. And along this, again, too, recognize your strength, recognize who you are. Because you may learn today a few things, but I hope you don't go to your class tomorrow and say, I'm going to do it like the speaker did yesterday. You may pick up some things, but don't try to be another teacher in how you present oral information. It has to be you. It has to be you. Because your students will pick up right away if you are trying to be somebody else. They read that a mile off. They do. And they don't appreciate that. They don't. Now, when do we have these oral sessions? Well, we'll start off with first thing in the morning. You likely have some kind of opening exercises, devotions in school. Maybe you read a portion out of the Bible, a Bible story. Maybe there's a little bit of a talk. Discuss maybe some characteristics, some Bible stories, some truth, some inspirational thoughts. Sometimes you may actually have students do this. I don't know. So that's a good oral skills development time. And each teacher and each student will do it different. One thing that you, however, as teachers can do, make sure that your students know how to read the Bible properly. For one thing, it is a special book because it's God's. And the Bible sometimes uses terms and uses words that are maybe a little more difficult to pronounce or words that we don't normally use every day, and especially some of the names. Oh my, I'd be tongue-twisted and tongue-tied with some of those names. I'm glad that my wife and I didn't name our children that way. But anyway, Because as important, because a lot of many of the terms and so on that are in the Bible are a little bit special and particular to the Bible. I remember, and I'm not saying this to be funny, but this actually happened, and it was humorous, and the student didn't do it intentionally. In Acts chapter 5, my students were reading. These were 6th and 7th graders. And they were reading, and it talks about Ananias and Sapphira, that sad story. And then the council, the Jewish council, doesn't want that Peter and the other apostles do any more preaching and miracles. They're supposed to stop this. And then in the English King James Version, it says in verse 17, something like this, and the high priest rose up, and those that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and were filled with indignation. Well, I had a 6th grade boy, he says, and they were filled with indigestion. I guess if you have indignation, you probably could have indigestion as well. But it gave a whole different understanding of what that verse was about. Now, he didn't do this intentionally, and I'm not saying this to because we respect the Bible for what it is, but I think it's important that our students learn to read the scriptures correctly, and that we take practice with that. It's a good oral skill. In any class, whether it's reading or whether it's discussions or whether it's questions and answers, give students to opportunity to participate, to ask questions and answers. And I know later in this outline that I have, there's how do we handle questions? How do we handle discussions? And we really won't take much time for that this morning. But there's different points and different ideas. But I think once in a while it's good, for example, to tell two students, okay, for tomorrow's, let's say these are grade 5, grade 6, whatever, and you've been looking at parts of speech and you've been talking about adjectives and adverbs. And you say, okay, now I want this student and this student to go home today, and tomorrow, once we have English class, I want you to clearly explain to the rest of the class, in your own words, what is the difference between an adjective and an adverb? Not just to read it from a dictionary, but to actually tell us what you know, what is the difference between these two terms. You give them a chance to prepare and to come back, hopefully with a clear explanation. Very, very helpful. Or in science, what's the difference between weight and mass? You know, things like that. Or that students demonstrate something, that students explain something in their own words. For one, it tells you what their description tells you a little bit how well they know it and how well they can explain it. Very, very, very important skills. Of course, there's all kinds of other oral opportunities. Even such things as reading poetry. You know, we tend to often read poetry in just a very monotone way, sing song. That's not how poetry should be read. I'm going to read a poem. Some of you may actually guess what this poem is after I've read it. It's called Evening Prayer. May this night, O Lord, I pray, sweetly calm and restful be. Keep all evil far away. With your blessing, cover me. May my body, soul, and mind, household, friend, and foe thus find quiet slumber, rest, and peace as God watches over us. O protect me from all harm. Shelter me with your strong arm. Keep ill health from me this night and the threat of war and might. Vanquish fire and waters high, may not plague and death come nigh. Let me not die in my sin and preserve my soul within. Hear me, O Almighty God, I, your child, your face has sought. Jesus, whom I would adore, my protector evermore. Holy Spirit, faithful guide, comforter by my right side, hear my earnest, fervent plea. Amen, yes, so shall it be. Do any of you recognize that poem? I know I'm not in another setting. You should. How many of you know the German evening prayer, Lass mich diese Nacht empfinden? There you have it. Okay? See, but we sometimes just rattle it off and in a certain tone, and we don't get it. Okay? Now here, of course, you heard it in a different language. And I tried to hopefully use a little bit of expression. I want to read a story, because I know you all like stories. This is not to entertain, although I hope you will enjoy this story because it's true. But I want you to tell me, after I've read this story, what lessons you think the author learned. It's a story about a dog. How many of you are familiar with the book Lessons from a Sheepdog? Ah, at least I can read it now and not have half the class know exactly where I'm going. It's called Lessons from a Sheepdog. It's written by Philip Keller. Philip Keller wrote many books. He is a very good writer. A lot of the books and stories he wrote are, they're not heavy. They're solid, good material. But they're not deep, deep, deep stuff. If I like to just have a relaxing evening of reading something good, inspirational, but not that requires a lot of deep thinking, I like to read Philip Keller. The story is taken from the book Lessons from a Sheepdog, and I want you to tell me what the lessons are. Lass, a beloved border collie. This is a simple story about a special dog who shared life with me on my first sheep ranch. She bore the ordinary name of Lass. She was an extraordinary dog. My memories of her companionship, loyalty, exuberance, and love linger long across the years as joyous, colorful recollections. Even more important and precious, however, were the powerful spiritual principles that God, my Father, enabled me to learn through working with this beautiful border collie. Some of us are slow to grasp the great basic truths of divine design. We cannot always clearly comprehend Christ's call to us in simple service. For that reason, his gracious spirit often uses the common experiences of life to shed intense light of supernatural truth on our path. In his gracious, generous way, God used this dog to help me clearly really see what he himself is like in his character and conduct. Beyond that, he taught me emphatically what his highest purposes and best intentions were for me as a friend and co-worker. And he does make it clear that we as his people, he calls us to special service to himself. As a boy, I grew up with cattle. On our land in East Africa, my father always bred the finest of breeds adapted to the tropics. Cattle were his joy. When I came to North America to complete my university training in science and animal husbandry, cattle still played an important part of my life. By my mid-20s, I had become a manager of one of the most beautiful ranches in the interior cattle country of British Columbia. Shortly after this, I found a piece of neglected ranch property on a peninsula of land on the southern tip of Vancouver Island. Because it was so abused, the place didn't attract much interest. But I saw potential in this piece of land almost entirely surrounded by the sea. It was an estate sale, so I had to pay cash. The net result was I did not have sufficient funds left to buy cattle. So I had to start with sheep. I might mention that through those first months at Fair Winds, which I called this spot, I began to wonder seriously why I had allowed myself to get stuck with sheep. Compared to cattle, sheep are so stupid, timid, frail, vulnerable to diseases and parasites, easy prey to predators. Little did I understand the wondrous works, ways of God. Little did I discern his hand at work behind the scenes in my affairs. Little did I realize the enormous eternal lessons he would teach me on those wind-blown acres as I struggled to make a beautiful country estate out of this rejected piece of property. One day there was a short advertisement in the city paper, and it said tersely, "Wanted, good country home for purebred border collie, chases, cars, and bicycles." I hurried to the neighboring rancher's home, phoned the owner in town, 27 miles away. "Yes," replied the lady, "I still have the dog. Please come quickly. Nobody else wants her." Her voice sounded desperate. In short order, I drove my old car down the winding country road, pulled up outside a cute little cottage in the city suburbs. The lady was waiting for me at the gate. Almost before I could get out of the car, she came over and began to talk excitedly. "Mr. Keller, I can't do a thing with this creature." There was a look of anger in her eyes. "The dog is plumb crazy. She's loco." She threw up her arms in despair. "All she does is tear after children, chase boys on bicycles, jumps all over the fences, races after every car that comes on the road." "Please let me see her," I requested. "Maybe I can do something with her. I've had dogs all my life." She led me around to the back of the house. As we entered the little yard, a flying, leaping bundle of dog flung herself at me. She snarled and snapped, collapsed in a heap on the ground. Instantly, to my shock and horror, I saw a dog that was not only chained from her collar to a steel post, but was hobbled by a second chain from her neck to her back leg. A pitiful sight. Crouched in the dirt, covered with dust, the dog glared at me. Her eyes, ears were laid back in anger. Deep, guttural, menacing growls rumbled in her throat. "How old is she?" I asked. "What's her name?" I tried to cover up the pity and love that welled up inside me. The owner replied that the dog was almost 2 years old. Her name was Lassie. I looked at this border collie with mingled emotions. She was a dog gone wrong, totally useless, sad spectacle, almost beyond hope and help. Yet I saw something in this dog. In her eyes, there was a keen intelligence. In her beautiful head, there was a great capacity to learn. She had a splendid constitution with a deep, wide chest, broad back, strong legs. A superb creature. With love, compassion, and empathy, I looked at this forlorn, hopeless animal crouched in the dust. "At 2 years old, most dogs have learned everything that they will ever know," I said, my eyes full of agony. "But she's too beautiful to destroy. I am prepared to give her a chance." The owner was still tense, waiting for my next words. "I will take her home to my ranch on one condition." I weighed each word carefully. "If I can't do a thing with her after 6 weeks, I will bring this dog back to you. She's too lovely for me to put her down. You must then destroy her." The lady gladly agreed. So I unhobbled Lass, that's what I would call her, led her out to my car, put her behind the front seat for the long ride home. All the way home, I talked to her softly and reassuringly in a low, gentle voice. All I got was low growls. Occasionally, I would try and put my hand back, touch and pet her, but she'd only bare her teeth and snap back angrily. I could see that 2 years of town life had been tough on her as well as on the owner. Reaching the ranch, I felt a peculiar inner reassurance that this torn, twisted dog could be redeemed. Our land lay at the very edge of the country road where it ran into the sea. There were virtually no cars to chase, no boys on bicycles to tempt her, just wide rolling pastures, wooded rocky ridges, rugged shoreline where the ocean bay waves thundered against the land. And more important, she had a new master. I gave her a kennel of fresh, clean bedding, bowl of sparkling water, dish heaped with delicious food. She wouldn't touch it. She refused to eat, drink, go into the kennel. Every advance made to touch and pet her was rejected. Any attempt to call or reassure her were resisted belligerently. Day followed day. She began to lose condition, and I thought I would lose her. In an act of faltering faith, I settled on a daring step. I decided to set her free. The instant I did, she fled into the forest behind the cottage. In a matter of moments, she had disappeared in view. I wondered if I'd ever see her again. For several days, I drove up and down looking for her. I asked other ranchers in the area to let me know if they saw her, but there was no sign. She had simply vanished into ocean air. One evening, I happened to glance up at the top of a large rock outcrop behind her house. On the summit, Lass lay crouched like a hunted cougar, looking down at me. I called her name. She turned and fled. That evening, I took food and water, placed them on the rock. At dawn, they were gone, so I fed her regularly, but no other response that I could make toward her. A couple weeks later, a small band of sheep grazed near her outlook. Suddenly, I noticed she took a keen interest in them. She would cock her head, rise on her haunches, watch them intently. Her instincts were coming to life. So evening after evening, when the day's work was done, I brought a few lambs and sheep to graze close to where she was. During this time, no other close rapport had been able to be established between Lass and me. I felt an enormous compassion for this beautiful dog. A tremendous longing was inside my whole being for her to come to me, to get to know me, to trust me, to learn to love me, to work with me, to be my friend. Yet now week was following week and the time was approaching. She'd have to be destroyed, and I was filled with dismay. One gentle evening, the sun was sinking in a golden haze over the ocean. The sheep were grazing contentedly in a lovely pastoral scene on the water's edge. I stood entranced, my hands clasped behind my back, caught up in the wonder of it all. The dog was not on my mind. And suddenly, I felt a warm, soft nose touch my hands. Lass had come. My heart seemed almost to stop with ecstasy. Elation, ecstatic delight swept through my senses. Contact had been made. She had found the fortitude to let me touch her life. And it was the turning point, the beginning of a remarkable companionship, the start of new adventures together. Quickly, she discovered she had a new master whom she could trust. She had one who cared for her, who really loved her, understood her, who had her best interests in mind. One who also knew everything about sheep and about ranching, about the exciting part that we could play together. On the basis of mutual affection and trust, I began to teach her common commands. Come, lie down, sit, fetch, stay, to the left, to the right. She readily understood, soon obeyed. One aspect of her personality that impressed me was the obvious pleasure she derived from doing what I asked her to do. Her eyes, large, brown, luminous, would shine and sparkle. Her whole face would be wreathed in a happy smile when I complimented her on her cooperation. From voice commands, we went to hand signals so that she could understand me and obey me at great distances. She would watch the movement of my right hand and outstretched arm. She became able to handle the sheep with remarkable skill and energy. As sometimes happens, word got out about this remarkable dog. Strangers would drive up from the city just to watch her work under her master's care. It was a fine compliment. One of the touching aspects of our relationship was her deep devotion. She became my virtual shadow. Where I went, she went. She always wanted me in full view. My presence was her peace and pleasure. She was a one-man dog. No one else could give her to eat and drink. Strange as it may seem, the most difficult command for her to obey was stay. Sometimes it meant she'd have to hold a bunch of lambs in the corner of a field, or guard a gate, or keep watch over some ruly rams while I was doing another job somewhere else. It was very trying when I would disappear from view. She wanted to be where the action was. She wanted to be on the move in the midst of excitement. So sometimes she'd be tempted to break faith, take off on other tempting escapades. Two of these were somewhat amusing. The first was a colony of crows that had their nests in the stunted, wind-blown trees on a small rocky island just off the shore. The black rascals would come winging over the fields, swoop down low over Lass, taunt and tease her with their raucous cries. Unable to restrain herself any longer, she would leap to her feet, race after them, her tormentors, literally flying across the field with her graceful body. almost airborne. It was a spectacular show, impressive display, but it didn't do the sheep, the ranch, or her master a particle of good. It was just a show. The second was when the big land-clearing fires were held every winter. Sometimes the flaming sparks and glowing cinders carried up and away into the wind were so exciting, she'd go leaping and bounding after them. Sometimes one of these cinders would get into her long coat, begin to burn with an acrid odor. She would roll wildly in the grass, shake herself, come running back to me and say, "Well, boss, wasn't that a great display?" Yes, it was, but only sapped her energies, wasted her strength, caused her to break faith. She would quickly sense that I was disappointed. She knew at once I'd let her down. She was aware that a coolness had come between us because of her misconduct. There'd have to be a severe scolding. There'd have to be a measure of strict discipline. She'd have to be taken in hand, corrected for failure to be faithful. These were difficult, agreeable moments, but they were essential for her well-being and for the well-being of me and the ranch. She was worth more than several hired men in handling the flock. She couldn't break faith. When the discipline was done, I would gather her in my arms, caress her head, rub her chest, whisper in her ear, "It's all over, girl." She, her eyes would shine again. Her whole frame would tremble with joy. There was restoration in pure pleasure. She'd leap out of my arms, race around in the grass, come leaping back to me as if to say, "I'm all yours." Perhaps the memory that lingers the most about this delightful dog was her willingness to do anything I asked of her. She was totally instantly available, no matter how tough or trying. On the ranch, there was some rugged, rough country. The sheep would scatter in this, looking for those sweet mouthfuls of grass that others had left behind. Because I was taller, I could see where the sheep were. She couldn't. So sometimes I'd have to send her out blind to gather in the flock. And I would say, "Bring him in, lass, bring him in. Don't leave a stray behind." And she'd go bounding away over the rocks, through the windfalls, through the rose thickets, no matter what the cost. Often she'd finally come up with all the flock, her face scratched, her fur clogged with burrs, her feet cut and torn, but she had obeyed, no matter the suffering that it had caused. Because of such devotion, such faithful service, such loving loyalty, great bonds of mutual respect, trust, and affection were built between. And I was learning from Lass exactly what it is that Christ, my great shepherd, wants to do with me in his fields as his co-worker. What do you think he learned? Yes, Anne-Marie. The shepherd gives him the freedom of choice. Very powerful lesson. Actually, let him go. Another lesson. There's many. Give him another chance. This dog looked hopeless, right? But he saw potential. Another one. Joanna. Give ourselves freely to the master. Full trust does that, right? When there's that love and trust relationship, that dog would just do anything. Something else. We could go on. There's the blessings of obedience, the need for discipline, and it actually improved the relationship. The tremendous patience that it takes. It's a powerful, the rest of this book, this is just the opening chapter, the rest of this book discusses various of these lessons. You know, and you start using stories like this. Probably, I don't know what you do in your schools, but when I went was a boy in school and I was a teacher, after lunch, what was it? It was story time. You could use that time to just take time to read. I know when I went to school and I went to public school, our teacher would read Hardy Boy books to us. Well, you've read one, you've read them all. They all start out at the same place and they all end at the same place. You know exactly when you start where you're going to end. I wish my teacher had read stories like this. Okay? A good story. But in fact, you don't even have to discuss the lessons. The lessons are just right there. Children all enjoy stories. There's hardly a one who doesn't. And it's a way of doing some very powerful oral skills teaching. Let's go on. On the next pages, what to read, what to report. We could talk about oral reports and all these things. I won't do that. We don't have time. One of the things that sometimes helps students if they have to do interviews, to interview each other or to interview their parents, you know, to ask questions and then record what their parents have said or the other person. I'd like to look at point number four, number L, to summarize or retell stories. That's something that all students should be able to learn how to do. I was in Africa this last winter again, Liberia, and I had my teachers summarize a story. And I found out that to them, the word summarize means something very different than what I understand. To me, summarize means you take this big story and you boil it down. Right? Guess what they did? They retold the whole story. That's not what I was looking for. I want the main point brought down to just a few sentences. That's a very important skill. We teach that in writing to our students and how to edit, how to be able to say things precisely, clearly, carefully. And I think it's important we teach our students to talk that way too. I'd like to look at, just for a few moments, on the last page, the use of appropriate language. In developing oral skills and working with our students with oral skills, be sure that they speak clearly. Words well chosen. Understandably. So that others can understand. Follow. That means that we have to do that. Use simple terms, simple sentences. We don't impress anybody by using big words that we can hardly say and that we hardly know. We speak simply, but clearly. Simple sentences. I once was translating for a dear brother, and he used it. He's an educated man, and he used rather complicated sentence structure. Long sentences, very complicated. Finally, I told him, he says, brother, see, and I was translating from English into German. Finally, I told him, I says, brother, you can speak simply because these people aren't listening to you, they're listening to me. They want to understand what I'm saying. So just talk simple so that I can get it too. Then I can also give it. Be careful about meaningless words. And I know we get into some habits. I probably have them too. And you probably have noticed them. I wish I knew what they all were. No, maybe I don't. Yeah. Things like that. After a while, it gets very tiring to listen to a person like that. About using specific words. You know, We teach our students in school about adjectives and adverbs, and you use them to describe things, to describe how. That's good. But somehow we sometimes get the idea the more adjectives and adverbs I use, the better the story will be. Uh-uh. No. The best stories use few. They use some adjectives and adverbs, but they use specific nouns and verbs. Okay? For example, instead of saying the huge, gorgeous, wonderful house in which the king lived, you talk about a palace, and that already says it. Or he walked slowly, dragging his... He shuffled. Okay? To use clear nouns and verbs, then you don't have to use a lot of descriptive adjectives and adverbs. You don't. And all these things you don't do overnight, it becomes a process. And I think one of the things that we as teachers need to do is train ourselves to be good communicators, and we will be able to help our students become clearer communicators as well. And as I said before, be careful about your volume. Be careful about your tone. Your flow of speech. That's a natural, normal type of communication. I'm to the end here. One person said this: knowledge is knowing what to say. Wisdom is knowing when and how to say it. Speaking is a very important thing. The Bible speaks about speaking, and it speaks about it that it should, it doesn't say don't talk, it says talk carefully. Basically. And we as teachers will. That's part of our job as teachers, is to talk. Not all the time. So let's talk well so that our students can also learn to become well talkers.